This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College, the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative, and a current Soros Justice Fellow. I'm also a member of the Practitioners Lab offered by Common Justice, a restorative justice organization located in New York City that's pioneered a model of how to work with district attorneys to refer cases of very serious violence to an intensive, accountability and healing-focused restorative justice process rather than to courts and prison. My guest today is also a member of the Practitioners Lab, in addition to many other roles that we're going to talk about. I am so thrilled to welcome Kempis Songster, who goes by Ghani, who is currently the Transformative Healing and Restorative Justice Manager for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. Welcome to Justice Radio, Ghani.
Hey, Catherine. Thank you for having me. It's such a blessing to be in the same space with you again just 2 weeks later.
Yeah, we were just together in New York 2 weeks ago for a wonderful, wonderful in-person set of meetings with the Practitioners Lab. So even though I first met Ghani in person through the Practitioners Lab, I'd heard of him through a 2021 article that he co-authored called Redeeming Justice that was published in the Northwestern University Law Review. The article stuck with me because it makes a powerful, moving case for the abolition of life sentences. The article asks, what does it mean for the law to judge some human beings as incapable of redemption? Isn't the capacity for change core to the human condition? And shouldn't that be reflected in the law? Today's show is the first in a series on Ghani's work toward abolishing life sentences and promoting restorative justice in cases of harm. The Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth works to end life without parole and other extreme sentences for children in the United States. The campaign is also invested in healing individuals directly impacted by youth violence and extreme sentences. But before Ghani joined the campaign, he did a whole lot of other stuff too. He was a founding member of several organizations, including Right to Redemption, the Redemption Project, the Coalition to Abolish Death by Incarceration. Ghani is also a co-founder and director of Ubuntu Philadelphia, and he worked for the Amistad Law Project and Philadelphia's flagship restorative justice organization, Healing Futures. So today we're going to delve into what brought Ghani to these roles, because his life story is both ordinary and extraordinary. So Ghani, I'm going to pitch it over to you. Where do you want to start in sharing with us how you, Ghani is wearing a baseball cap that says, find your purpose. So Ghani, I'm going to ask you to tell us where you want to start in tracing your journey for how you found your purpose.
Let's start at the beginning and I'll move through it fairly quickly. I spent my first 7 years in Trinidad of the islands nation, Trinidad and Tobago. From 1972 to 1979, when I immigrated to the U.S., and then spent the next 8 years in Brooklyn, New York, the concrete jungles of Brooklyn, New York, which was an environment that was starkly different than Trinidad and Tobago, as you might imagine. But I spent those next 8 years continuing my high performance in school, you know, because I was doing very well in school in Trinidad, you know, and that carried over into the U.S. for some years. It was in all advanced grades, gifted. I went to the Philippa Schuyler Intermediary School for the Gifted and Talented, the same high school that Mos Def went to, in fact. And he was in the grade under me. And it's also written about, by the way, how he would come to my rap circles when I used to rap.
I love hearing
and was inspired. Yeah, and was inspired and brought his first written raps to recite them to me for my appraisal of them and stuff like that. Of course, I would be like, yeah, those are dope, you know. But anyway, he made choices that was consistent with his potentials. And I would go on to make choices that betrayed my potentials, you know, at the age of 15, about a week before completing the ninth grade. This was in June 1987. You know, I ran away to Philadelphia, 250 plus miles away or so, with a childhood buddy. And there I joined some unsavory company, you know, and a criminal organization. For the next 4 months, along with other runaway children, because that's who worked in this organization, were runaway children from all around the country, was holed up in fortified row homes, selling drugs for this organization. So again, 4 months later, I was arrested for my involvement in a fatal act of violence that occurred in one of those houses, a fight, an argument that erupted into a fight that ended in a death that I was directly involved in, and was 10 days later then arrested inside the police station. And that was the last time I saw the light of day for the next 30 years. So I was condemned to, I know you called it life without parole, Kathy, and I used to call it that for a while, but the sentence is more increasingly known now in Pennsylvania, at least, and in other parts of the country as death by incarceration. And I just wanted to point that out, that we really want to be intentional about pointing out what the sentence is, naming it what it is, because it is, at least in Pennsylvania anyway, it is the other death penalty, you know, because unlike in other states where you might serve 20 years, 25 years, or any number of years, and then you're eligible to see the parole board. No such possibility exists in Pennsylvania once you're given that sentence. You're sent to prison effectively to die, and that's it. And so many of us behind the walls, you know, those of us who found, you know, we founded a group called Right to Redemption. And Right to Redemption is featured in the piece that you mentioned, Redeeming Justice. Right. We were very intentional about changing the way we thought about the sentence and the way we spoke about the sentence. And so we were deliberate about the language we would use to refer to the sentence. You know, we didn't want to use a term as beautiful as life, because we know what life implies, to identify something so associated with death as the sentence we were condemned to was. And so we decided to call it death by incarceration.
Yeah, I'm just going to interrupt to say I really appreciate making that point. You may not know this, but Maine has no parole either. We're one of 16 states with no parole. And so young people who get life sentences are condemned to die in prison.
Yeah.
We are also barred by our state constitution from second chance legislation. So once you get a life sentence as an 18, 19, 20-year-old, there's absolutely nothing that can be done to mitigate that sentence, no matter how you live your life once you're inside. It's absolutely a death by incarceration. So thank you clarifying that term and the importance of using that term rather than life without parole.
Yeah. And, you know, not to be discursive or anything here, because I know, you know, I'm supposed to be, you know, talking about my journey, you know, but this is a part of it too. And I want to lift up this, you know, this very important piece for those who are listening. You know, one of the reasons why we decided to name the sentence what it really is and what it really implies was because we found ourselves in a very peculiar situation fighting to end the sentence. And that is that the strongest proponents or the strongest advocates of life without parole were opponents of the death penalty. You know, that was eye-opening for us, you know, because we always saw opponents of the death penalty as our allies. You know, and they are, you know, we believe that the death penalty is wrong, you know, on all faces. And but we didn't think that they necessarily had to throw us under the bus to make that point. And by us, I mean people condemned to life without parole sentences. We didn't think that they were doing it out of malice, you know, because they were offering, you know, you would hear people who were fighting the death penalty saying, well, life without parole is the more humane sentence. It's the more humane option, and so on and so forth. And we didn't think they were doing it out of malice or because they just didn't care. We just thought that they didn't know that life without parole, especially as you describe it in Maine, as, and the way I was experiencing it in Pennsylvania, that it was just, the sentence is just as final as the death penalty. You know, the death penalty is more acute. You know, a needle is literally hanging over a person's veins, you know what I'm saying, every day of their life. It's acute. But life without parole is just a regulated death. It's slow and regulated death. And it's like you said, it's no matter what you do. And I know people who have went on to earn their bachelor's, their master's and PhDs behind the walls, that will not count for anything. There is still no opportunity for that to mean anything to a board of responsible people that could use that to say, well, look, this person might be ready for consideration to reintegrate back into society. There may be more utility value in this person's life outside than just to vegetate behind the walls. That there is no possibility of that. And so we said, you know what, we have to educate our friends who are fighting the death penalty and let them know, look, this is just as final as the death penalty. And actually, in Pennsylvania, the last person to be executed was Gary Heidnik in 1999. And he literally begged to be executed. If he didn't push so hard to be executed, he might not have even been executed at the time. And since then, no one has been executed in the state of Pennsylvania on that was on death row. However, between that time and now, hundreds and hundreds of people serving life without parole sentences have died serving that sentence. From cancers, from all, you know, natural cause, all kind of issues. And so it could be argued that life without, more people die on life without parole than on death row. So that it could be argued that the sentence of life without parole is actually more fatal than the death sentence. You know what I mean? And so we decided to call the sentence what it is, death by incarceration. So I just wanted to lift that up. And this became part of my journey. I was among the condemned, and condemned at 15 years old. And you know, Kathy, that nowhere else in the world was that sentence, you know, implemented. You know, America at the time had between 2,800 and 3,000 people condemned to death by incarceration / life without parole for offenses they committed under the age of 18 or when they were adolescents. But the rest of the whole world combined had zero people sentenced that way. So I think outlier is we need to come up with another term to describe America's position in that, how it sentences people, especially young people. Maybe aberration, maybe deviant, but not outlier. You know what I mean?
Because maybe we're perverse.
Exactly. You know what I mean?
It's a perverse deviation.
Right. And 80% and 80% of everyone in the world sentenced to the life without parole, as you describe it, and I describe it, Kathy, is in the U.S.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's a very, very unique sentence. So it basically says you have no redemptive qualities. Mm-hmm. There is no even a consideration. It's irrelevant whether you have the human capacity for transformation and change. That is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And so I lived with that for 30 years. And mind you, I never felt as I was entitled to be free. I knew I had done something irreparably and irreversibly wrong. You know, I describe it as leaving a tear in the fabric of life or a hole in the cosmos.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
And that can never be fulfilled. It can never be filled, you mm-hmm. know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how I describe it. And so I know that I'll have to spend the rest of my life atoning or trying to atone, you know? But what I am saying is that no one has the right to tell a human being that they don't have the capacity to be better, that they don't have the capacity to be more responsible mm-hmm. in their decision-making, and that they don't have the capacity to give something good back to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the sentence of death by incarceration basically says all of that. You know, it forecloses even the possibility of a human being giving back to the world. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. This is Justice Radio, and today we're having a conversation with Kempis Ghani Songster about his life journey, being condemned to die in prison at the age of 15, to finally gaining his freedom after 30 years inside, and his work in making an argument that every human being has the right to redemption, no matter what, and that the practice that we engage in the United States of sentencing people to death by incarceration, and especially sentencing children to death by incarceration, is a perverse aberration globally. We are the only country that does this, and we need to undo it. Ghani, I want to turn back to your story now. It's an extraordinary one in the sense of being sent to prison at the age of 15 with a sentence that was intended for you to die there, and finding your way to another group of youngsters similarly condemned to death by incarceration, and finding your way toward developing language around the right to redemption, and forming a group together with other people that with whom you were incarcerated to begin to make this argument, and making it so powerfully that you were able to gain not only the attention of law professors at Northwestern University, but the United Nations for your campaign. So can you talk to us a little bit about what happened inside that allowed you as young as children, becoming young men, to find your voices in this way, to find each other, and to begin to build this campaign?
Yeah, thank you so much for that. This is really, really an important development, the birth of Right to Redemption, which is the group that we founded behind the walls in 2011. So it took some time. It took a long time for all of us that was involved in this process and this effort. We had all been behind the walls for over 25 years at this time. You know, we had seen the failures of the movement to end life without parole. You know, we had seen how unpopular the issue was. You know, because of, like we said, a lot of people believe that life without parole is a more humane approach. You know, I was actually watching a cartoon one time that they were showing behind the walls, and it was a Justice League cartoon, Superman. I just found myself watching, and the villain in the case was captured at the end, and you can hear Superman approach his Justice League team saying, yeah, and I think the character was named Sebastian or something like that. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. I never heard the language of life without parole or life without the possibility of parole in a cartoon before. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, by the greatest of all comic superheroes, Superman. Now, if Superman is all right with life without the possibility of parole.
Yeah. Wow. No,
this is what we have to contend with. You know, it's almost like the sentence is being promoted like something heroic. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Mind-bending.
So I'm like, oh my goodness. So this is what we have to contend with. And no wonder why the sentence was never really able to make it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, we watch advocates struggle to fill up a charter bus to go to the state capitol on this issue. So when we came together in 2011, it was almost like the way it happened, the president of the Lifers Incorporated, which was a prisoner-ran organization that was founded for the express purpose of winning or effecting some type of parole eligibility for people sentenced to life without parole. He gathered a group of us who were kind of like leaders in the prison. You know, we were good writers, we were good speakers, we were good analysts, and he just tried to get all of us together. And he was like, look, we can't keep doing things the way we've been doing it. How can we move this struggle to end life without parole forward? And we just started, we spent months debating each other before we even came up with an idea. The idea of redemption was on a lot of our minds, and we decided that maybe that can be the centerpiece of this whole thing, was the concept of redemption. Now, for a long time, though, redemption, if you look in all the law dictionaries, Barron's Law Dictionary, Black's Law Dictionary, all the law dictionaries, even if you go back to Webster's Dictionary, going back to 1847, the original definition of redemption was a financial, it was a financial transaction. It was kind of like a buy back. That's what it means to, yeah, it means to buy back, right?
Right.
A redemptioner is somebody who buys back their freedom, like working on a master ship, you know, especially after slavery and so on and so forth. And so if you look this up, you know, so we were aware of this. And so we were very like hesitant about using it as a bunch of African-American men to using a term that means buying back our freedom, you know, after slavery and stuff. Like we were thinking about, we were like, okay, now this is not the redemption that we had grown up being oriented around, which was this concept of redemption as like a spiritual thing or moral kind of return, as we were reading about in the Bible and stuff like that. But as I started reading about the concept of redemption around the world, Catherine, according to the Judaic faith, I think the concept of galut, being exiled and banished, and then the opposite concept of geula, being returned to the community, right? Redemption, right? And then reading about redemption in Islam and reading about redemption in the Hindu faith and all of these and Buddhist faith, you know, it seemed that there was a common a consensus in cultures around the world about the human capacity, a human being to right itself or right him or herself or redeem themselves or realign themselves after they fell out of alignment and committed a wrong. And so that excited us. That definition excited us. And so we thought about, okay, let's, and then we started reading about the right to redemption as a human right. You know, and so we said, let's center this on the right to redemption, and let's make the case or make the argument that we have the capacity to be changed human beings, and we can be an asset to the community as we knew we were. And then we also thought about how to, you know, changing the way we thought about ourselves, you know, that we were not entitled to be free. We knew we did wrong. Right. But we wanted to be back in the good graces of the community, and we wanted to prove ourselves, and we wanted to atone. Right. And so that was the birth of kind of like an exploration of accountability. And for some of us, that would lead us to restorative justice, you know, because accountability is one of the core values of restorative justice. Right. So for me, my foray into a restorative justice was this newfound appreciation of the human capacity for redemption, transformation, right, and accountability. And for me, accountability was fulfilling my obligations, you know, fulfilling my obligations to the people that I'd hurt, to the families that I'd hurt, to my own family, and to the community that I had left in a state of imbalance by my actions. All of that went into an analysis, the analysis of right to redemption. When I came home in 2017, December 28th, I met back up with Rachel Lopez, who was a human rights professor that I met behind the walls. And she came in as part with her, with some other faculty members from Drexel University to participate and a community-based learning workshop with us. And she was excited by the concept of a right to redemption. And she knew, as a human rights lawyer, about the right to redemption. So when I came home, me and her met up and we fleshed this out some more. And she had this idea of writing an article making the argument about the human capacity for right for redemption as a human right based on international law, and how the sentence of life without parole slash death by incarceration is a violation of that right, right? Her job was to make the legal argument, and my job was to just bring in a voice that's normally missing in legal cases and in policies, and that is the voice of those who are most harshly impacted by those laws and policies. Then we also reached back and got Terrell Carter, who was still on the inside serving a death by incarceration sentence, and he was the chairman of Right to Redemption, and my friend who I had left behind when I came home, and he was the third contributor. So the three of us we wrote this piece called Redeeming Justice. Rachel weaved it all together into a legal argument, all 63 pages of it. And we just took a blind leap of faith and launched it into the stratosphere of public consciousness. And next thing you know, it was published in Northwestern University, and it created a buzz, both positive and negative, and inspired the first ever legal complaint against death by incarceration in the United Nations by a coalition of organizations. Yeah.
And that's how I found my way to that article, was the legal complaint filed against the United States and the United Nations that referenced your article. We've covered a lot. We have so much more to cover. Our show is coming to a close. We still have to go back and talk about how you went from being condemned to death by incarceration with a sentence to being out in 2017, and what was the process that led to that. And I want to highlight, because this is what we're going to talk about in our next show, I want to highlight the relationship between the argument that you made about the human right to redemption and the importance of allowing for and enabling and supporting accountability, atonement, and contributing to one's community in the wake of having caused harm. Those are all interwoven, and that's what builds strong, safe communities, and not ripping people out of community and then condemning them to die in a carceral setting. So thank you for making that connection for us. So Ghani, we're going to come back next month with our second episode in this series. And I'm going to close us out by thanking bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, as well as Aaron Pyle, our sound engineer, and Daria Cullen, our executive producer. We are Justice Radio.